Good afternoon. Is everyone having a good tech ed? Good. This room is spectacular to speak in, I have to say. Look at this big stage. I can dance, I can sing, except that I can't. I'm glad you're having a good tech ed. I've been having a great time spending time with all of you talking about everything from Visual Studio to TFS to agile development to TDD and fakes and stubs and shims and just all kinds of things. It's wonderful. I love spending time with you guys, and thank you for having us back again. And I do love Amsterdam. My name is Peter Provost. I'm a senior program manager lead with Visual Studio ALM. I've been working for the last few years focusing primarily on the developer experience with an even tighter focus on lighting up for agile development. And the tasks and the experiences that will really make the developer delighted with our product. But this session is going to be the entire story. So 2.5 years ago, or a little bit longer, when we first started planning out what this release was going to be, a whole bunch of us got together, and we started telling stories about what we wanted to do with the product this time around. And we created storyboards, as I'm sure many of you have done. And we took the storyboards and we iterated over them and we talked to people and we took them to customers and we took them to MVPs and we went back around to management stakeholders just to get a sense of the big picture of what we wanted to do, what we were really going to try to accomplish to make this really be a strong experience for agile teams. And what I'm here to show you today then is the result of that. And hopefully, like I do, you're going to like what you see. How many of you are doing agile development right now at work? All right. Okay. And how many of you are using TFS and Visual Studio 2010 right now? Okay. And have any of you started using 2012 yet? Okay. That's good. So we have been, of course, using everything that I'm going to show you. My team, my specific crews, my teams, have been using for more than a year. Everything. Sometimes, depending on when it first came online for us, it may have been in early versions a year and a half ago that we started using them. So the structure of the talk today is as follows. We're going to talk a little bit about how an agile team prioritizes work and what the act of prioritization means. And I'll show you how the new tools in TFS 2012 help us do that. Then we'll move into a planning, and we'll look at how we do planning. And in particular, we'll be looking at how we do planning for Scrum, because I'll be showing you the Scrum process templates for TFS, and what it means to plan. It's a little bit different than if you've done non-agile. Now, all of you put your hands up, so I'm guessing some of that stuff is going to be things you already know or perhaps just looking for clarity on. The execute loop, this constantly cycling loop of development and test and delivery and customer feedback is where we'll go then. And then at the end, we'll talk about responding to change. Now, I want to take just a second and talk about the Agile Manifesto. So almost 11 years ago, not quite, a bunch of people who were very deeply involved in what was then called lightweight software or lightweight processes, got together in Utah to figure out a way if they could come up with some common language and some approaches. And the thing that really matters here, and this is where a lot of people struggle when they first start getting into Agile, is recognizing that we're not ever saying the ones on the bottom don't matter. The idea is that when in conflict, the ones on the top matter more. And it's always been quite interesting to me that if you look at Agile and the books and the consultants and the trainers and the tool vendors like us and everybody else, processes and tools sitting right there at the bottom, right? And yet it seems that we do spend a fair amount of time talking about that. But hopefully by talking about it in settings like this, it means when you get back to work, you can stop talking about it so much and you can focus instead on individuals' interactions and working software and the other things that we care about so much. The other thing I found when talking to customers about Agile is that while almost everybody has seen the four value statements. Not very many people bother to scroll to the bottom and click through and read the 12 principles. And they're actually better. Oh, we got a couple hands. So yeah, I have. I actually think they're better. They just don't make very good slideware. Right? Four things are much easier to put on a slide than 12 paragraphs. So otherwise, you just get the data dump. So this is the context in which we've been working for the last decade to try to work out how can we produce software in a way that is lightweight, focuses on delivering working software, has high levels of customer collaboration, allows us to be reactive and responsive, responding to change. Because, of course, that's the world we're in now, especially with software. Software ships how often? As often as you possibly can. Because otherwise you're not competitive in the marketplace, you're unable to react and respond to your customers' needs. And of course, we have teams of people who do this. This doesn't happen in silos. What I'm finding now more and more is, in fact, we have geographically dispersed teams. How many of you work on a team where a chunk of your team is not in the same city you live in? Look at that. More than half of the room. So I told you I work for Microsoft and I work on the Visual Studio Tools team. So you would naturally presume that I live in Redmond, Washington. Except I don't. I live in Denver, Colorado. My team is geographically dispersed as well. And I'm not the only one who is, in fact, spread around. So let's go ahead and get started through our agenda, and we'll start working our way through the various the various aspects that I want to cover here. And we've got demo stops along the way, as I'll show you the product. But each one of them is going to start with a bit of an explanation of some of the process stuff. So here we are thinking about prioritizing. So we have an idea of a product we want to build. We have some ideas of things that we want it to do. We've maybe met with some customers or not. Maybe it's just a vision thing. We know what we want to build. And we need to think about what to work on first. So I've been told that the word grooming is potentially problematic in some nationalities, but it is what we have called it for quite a while. So forgive me if it offends. Grooming in this concept is like organizing, cleaning, structuring, paying attention to, stack ranking, asking questions, talking about the items on the backlog. Our goal is to try to identify those things that we care about the most. And of course, how do you decide if you care about something? It's not just how much do I like it. Although, as we found in the Birds of a Feather session just an hour ago or 20 minutes ago, sometimes it is the most recent new sexy cool thing that gets all the attention. But that isn't the only factor. Sometimes how big something is, how expensive it is, how many customers will it affect, how many dollars or euros will it bring to me, those things matter. So when we're prioritizing the backlog, you know, we're reordering, we're restructuring, we're moving things up and down. And this is a tricky exercise. I've found in the number of years I've been doing this that there are a lot of people who will almost refuse to do it. My manager for a long time really struggled with the idea of actually having to choose this one or this one. I want them both. I understand. But if we had to deliver tomorrow, which one would you pick? Well, I don't want to answer that question. Okay, I understand. I really do. But pretend with me. Pretend we had to deliver in a week. Which one would you pick? And so reluctantly, you can back them into the situation. Sometimes the other game I play is I say, okay, fine. Look, there's 37 items on the backlog, but you can only have 36. Get rid of one. And you whittle your way up from the bottom. It's like a reverse bubble sort. Either way, it doesn't matter. You have to be prepared to have these adjustments, slide things up, slide things down, reassess their size, reassess their value, reassess their customer impact, their ability to bring you revenue. Because after all, we wouldn't be building software. Very few of us, let me put it that way, very few of us are building software for altruistic reasons. So we move it up, we stick it in its spot. Now, organizing a product backlog is more than just taking a card or a work item and giving it a title. there are a number of important characteristics that make a good product backlog item. And you can call them user stories if you want. That's really more of a stylistic thing. A user story is always very intentional about its structure. But one of the most important things, regardless of the type of product backlog item that you use, is to be extremely clear on what done means for that item. What are its acceptance criteria? And those acceptance criteria need to be negotiated with and ideally maybe even defined by the product owner. I've actually found, I play the role of a product owner on my teams, and I've found that, in fact, I get some very good acceptance criteria from the team. We talk about it a lot. And they'll come up with edge cases and things that I didn't think of. I've often said, I am a terrible tester. I am not very good at breaking software. Because once I find the happy path, there's no natural instinct for me to deviate. So it means also when I'm thinking about the acceptance criteria for a story, I often think happy path only. And I've got some great people that I work with who are very good at finding the ugly path and proposing perhaps some other acceptance criteria. You know, if I enter an invalid credit card number, what happens? I'm like, well, why would you do that? It just doesn't even occur to me all the time. So let's take a look at what we have in TFS 2012 for backlog management. Now, I'm sure you guys have all done backlog management in Visual Studio and TFS 2010, right? And organizing and stack ranking your backlog is a wonderful experience. How many of you used Excel? I did. That's why my hand's up. Excel was the only way I could figure out to deal with this problem. It was not pleasant. I didn't like it at all, but it worked. And you also do that game. I see a few of you who are old enough to remember this with me. Remember programming on the old Apple IIs in BASIC? And we would type in our programs, and we had to make sure that we did our line numbers in increments of 10. Why did we do that? To leave room to put one in between, right? And then you put two in between, and three in between, and four in between, and suddenly you're out of room again. So then we wrote other programs that would renumber the whole line, the whole program back to 10 again. You do this when you're stack ranking in Excel, and it is not a pleasant experience. So instead, if we take a look at what we have done in 2012, what we now have, and just to prove it to you, is a web page. So here I am in my browser. I'm going to full screen it just to save us some real estate. This is a web page, highly interactive, dynamic, faster than any version of TFS web we've ever created. And it is very easy for me to work in now. So for example, one of the things we're commonly doing as product owners is creating new product backlog items. This is one of the things we do when we're managing the backlog like this. And so, you know, we need to talk, we need to get We need to get to our talk on time. You guys didn't realize it, but 12 minutes ago, I was on the other side of the building having a great conversation, and David said, your talk starts now. So we need to get to our talk on time. You saw how fast and easy that was. Was it that easy in Excel? No. Right? No forms to open up, no pop-ups. I was able to get it in and get a title for it. I want to prioritize it. I drag it, and I move it. You notice how fast this is. I'm not having to mess around with anything. I'm not dealing with Excel. I'm not even dealing with the numbers. This is how it should have been all along, right? We all know this, but it wasn't, and hopefully this is going to make your lives a lot easier if you're a product owner working in the backlog. And of course, we need to have our acceptance criteria. So we need to be able to come in here and put our acceptance criteria and define them. But we also may want to use some of the other capabilities we have to help define the product backlog item, to define the user story. We may create storyboards. I don't know if you guys have seen our new storyboarding capabilities, but I can just say I want to start storyboarding, and believe it or not, yes, it opened up PowerPoint. Because it's probably the best drawing tool we made at Microsoft, right? And it's quite nice to work in. I'm working in a SharePoint site, and I need a button or a date picker. There we go. And suddenly I'm able to wireframe my application very nicely, very quickly, exactly the way I want. It's PowerPoint, which means when I need to go to my stakeholder, I'm already ready to go. You know, you push F5 on the deck and you can show it at the meeting. You can take this, put it right back into the work item. And now the team has it as a wireframe of your intent. And of course, you get animations with PowerPoint, you can have transitions, all the other things we can cover. It's actually a great way to do this. And I believe there are some sessions, it might not be here at Europe, but there certainly have been sessions at North America that you could watch on video, where the PowerPoint tooling goes into more detail. So we've done that, we've done our storyboarding, and we're back over here, and so we need to put in some acceptance criteria. We'll work with the team to define those, define all that out. We'll put some nice descriptions in here of what the story is. We'll get all that done. Perhaps give it an effort or a business value. These are important. When we prioritize our work, the priority of the work is not just a function of how cool I think it is. How much it costs matters. Do you want the thing that sells advertising? Yes. It costs $1 million. Never mind. Right? Or in the session I was just doing, you know, I said, do you want me to answer this question or that question? Because it was one of those kind of talks. And I said, what if I told you this one was going to take me an hour to answer? Okay, yeah, never mind. It matters. It's an important component. Now, sometimes the trick is to figure out how to make it smaller. Can I have part of it? That would be better. So having done all of this then, having filled in all of those artifacts, I can then stack rank them, I can organize them. And sometimes your manager comes to you and says, how long is that going to take? And so we can use those other columns for that. We can organize out our columns. We can even, if you want to, we can even create child work items. I'm not a huge fan, but if you need to, you can create child. We can do all of this directly from the website. And you notice how fast it is. And I am not connecting to a TFS instance on my machine here. I'm using the TFS preview in the Azure cloud from my network wire here. Yes, I took a bit of a risk with that given how I heard things went yesterday. But so far, so good. And you can see it's nice and speedy. And this is exactly the way the tooling should be. It should not be getting in your way because we care more about customers' interactions, individuals and interactions and all those other things than the tooling. The tooling should not be the blocker for you. And of course, if you're a dispersed team, and a whole lot of you did raise your hand, you're going to really like having this in this way on the web. So when I was in my team rooms back in Redmond, I was a huge fan of sticky notes on the wall. I thought that was the best way ever to organize a project, and everything else was a waste of time. I can't read the sticky notes from Denver. Even with a good camera, I've tried. You know, I get one of those sweet HD cameras and say, put it up close there. Oh, right, now I can see it. No, it doesn't work so well. But with this, I hit the website and I'm work. And I can constantly be working my backlog as the product owner. And that's my job. Make sure that backlog is always ready to go so the next highest priority item is at the top and the team is ready to proceed. So that prioritizing effort is the primary job of the product owner. It's about defining what it is we're going to build, owning that vision, keeping the work organized and structured, having clear definitions of what things are, when they're done, when they're not, keeping it all up to date and organized in the tool. And as we know, all of you who laughed when I mentioned Excel, we know that doing it in Excel made that hard because you always ended up with your copy of the Excel and his copy of the Excel, and I couldn't get the data connection to work, and there's way too many problems. So now it's all in one place and easy to work with. So we're always doing that. That's a never-ending process. I am constantly messing around with my backlogs. I'm always organizing the work and playing with it a little bit. But then there comes the time, and remember, we're talking about Scrum, a Scrum process here. There comes the time when you need to stop and do some planning. How much planning do we do? One sprint's worth. And the act of planning is the act of organizing the team into a unit that understands exactly what it is we're going to do during this time window. And all the questions that they need answered get answered. And that goes both ways. So that means the product owner can get a much more precise sense of how much work there is to do and when they can expect to see it delivered. We can negotiate on the features and the changes and everything else. So planning then is the act of taking items off of the product backlog and moving them into the sprint backlog. Now, I am a huge fan of an estimation technique for tasks, by the team called Planning Poker. Didn't bring my cards, but we all, I think, understand what this is. Right? Everybody on the team gets their own little slice of cards, and the team talks about the tasks and the task list, and then we take each one of those tasks and everybody holds up their card. And if we all hold up something that's close, you just move on. Right? It's when I hold up a 3 and David holds up a 3 and Klaus holds up a 47. That's when we have to have a conversation. And that's always a very interesting time for the team. But we talk it through. We have a good, rich conversation about why 47, why 3. What did you assume that I didn't, or vice versa? And then we take that work, we adjust it. So now we've adjusted it over there. Take what we think we're going to bring over, and we enter in our tasks. We put our tasks into the system. These are now a much more precise definition of the work. Now, personally, I think that tasks are owned and defined by the team members themselves. As a product owner, I try not to get too involved. As an experienced software developer, and I have to have this two-hat thing, I will get involved. I don't think you should do it that way. But that's not me playing product owner. That's just me playing guy who's been writing code since he was 10 years old. So I really don't want to care very much about these as the product owner. I just need to know that if you do them all, I'm going to get the story I wanted. That's really what matters to me. So they figure out what their tasks are, and they start tasking it all out, and we start entering it all in. Say, okay, that looks pretty good, except we kind of picked too much. So we picked 3 product backlog items, and if we just assume for a minute that, you know, they're all roughly the same size, which of course isn't true. But if we were to assume that for a minute, we picked 3 because, well, we've always done about 3, and 3 seems to be about right, except this one's really big, and so is the one above it. So we're too big. Well, we have a few choices about what we can do here. We could attempt to start it and just expect not to finish it. I would recommend against that. I have seen teams do it, and that's okay. They've been successful at it. Sometimes I've seen teams that'll do it, and what they'll say is, we're going to do 1 and 2, and this one's a stretch goal. Personally, what I rather do is put it back. Can't do that one. But I still have a little bit of room here, so maybe we'll take that one. That fits. There's no right answer here. You have to find a system that works for you and for your team. But I will tell you, getting into the habit of regularly having work that carries over from one sprint and is unfinished is not a very good idea. You will very often find that as you transition from one sprint to the next, your prioritization of that work changes. We found it in the Birds of a Feather session, and David mentioned that he has seen it numerous times at real customers, where a story or a product backlog item doesn't finish, carries across the boundary into the next sprint, and now the product owner doesn't want it anymore. You really shouldn't have started it if he's changed his mind. And the idea of trying to force the first third of it in to try to force fit it is what led you to this place. You instead might have been able to get something else that the product owner did want. So be very careful about that stretch goal game. So this says commit up here, and there's a long-running argument in a number of the Agile communities, Scrum and others, about the word commit. I will be completely honest with you. I'm not a fan of the word commit. In the older Scrum literature, the idea of the crew committing was meant as a psychological coming together. Yay, we're going to do it. We're committing to ourselves that we are going to do this. We are going to commit to winning the football game, whatever. But unfortunately, what we saw happen is it became commit to the manager, who then held a stick over you. Right? You committed to me that you were going to finish that. Why isn't it done? And this is not an environment that we want to try to encourage. This is an environment that is guaranteed to lead to low-quality software. Because as soon as we take away the flexibility, we are only left with the variable of quality to adjust. And we don't want that. Quality is a variable. You should not allow quality to become a variable. You should insist on high quality. Appropriately high quality. If you're working on space shuttle software or something like that, perhaps your quality bar needs to be a little higher than if you're building a website that can redeploy tomorrow. We know, for example, that a lot of the web, the quote, web 2.0 companies and the social network companies are quite happy to roll something out and then tomorrow go, oops, sorry, that was broken. You know, their quality good enough is a different level than what I can do with Visual Studio when I have to ship it on a much broader schedule than that. So think about what that line is. But once you decide what it is, it has to be your line. And you don't want quality to be the variable you adjust. Instead, ideally, you adjust the what, how much. And we call this variable scope. So anyway, that's a little bit about commit. So ignoring that for a second, the team then enters into the sprint, which we'll come to in just a second. So let's look at how does this stuff manifest itself in the product. So here we have a backlog. And you can see I actually have already done a little bit of this by assigning some of these work items to Sprint 7. I need to undo the mess I was making just a second ago while I was showing off features. Move that guy back out here. There we go. So don't you just love how fast this is? Those little wheels spin over there and you just don't worry about it. So the act of selecting this work into the sprint is as simple as drag and drop. Take them over here and drop them on 7. Done. I just assigned those three to Sprint 7. So if we go over here and take a look at 7 then, there's a bunch of things that we can see here. So first of all, the team has started, the team has started to task out the work to give the tasks time remaining. This is an important thing. The only quantitative count that you should care about in tasks is how much is left. I'm not a huge fan of saying comparing how much you did versus how much is left versus your original estimate. We all like to think that we can use that to become better estimators. We are not good estimators. As a field, as a business, we are not. So I would rather just accept that I am a terrible estimator. And I'm being very honest, I really am. I always underestimate by a factor of 2. So if I tell you it's a week, it'll be 2. But I'm consistent. That's got something going for it, because what it means is that sprint, over the course of a long product cycle, you can make predictions about exactly how much I'm going to be able to finish by looking back and seeing how much I finished last time. I said 2 hours. Doesn't matter what it took me. I can finish the same amount next time. So the team is then going along here and entering in tasks. And again, this is just as simple as we have for entering in the stories. Now, of course, why do we pop up the dialogue? Because, well, the team is going to have a conversation about how much time is it? And that's the planning poker part. They also may be writing some notes to themselves about what they need to do. They might be putting in links to other artifacts that they've got in TFS or to tests or various other things. And we do all of this, and we enter in more tasks. Oops, it's not happy with me. Must fill in the title field. So we have all of our tasks. We give them all our remaining work. So that one's got about 12 hours left, and this one's maybe got 4. You'll notice there is no field for original estimate in the Scrum 2.0 template. Now, what we might want to do is we may want to get a sense of loading. And some teams like to do this and some don't. So it's an optional thing you can turn on or off. If I go up here to the right-hand side and I turn on this work details that you saw at the beginning, I'm getting some bar charts to help me understand how much is being assigned both by activity and to individual people and for the entire team. So here at the top, we can see 240 of 212. I'll show you where the numbers, where the of numbers come from in just a second. And so I can look here and I can see we're a bit under in development, which means we have a whole bunch of other activities that are consuming us. Aaron is very much overloaded, and I don't have enough work. So where these come from is we just simply jump over here to the capacity tab. And if you've used the Excel workbooks in 2010, you're familiar with this concept. You go over here. Here's how many units I will be able to do per day. I like to work in hours. You'll notice all of these are unitless. You have to pick the unit you like. This many per day, I will be doing this kind of an activity. And how many days off do I have? It's also a good one to track during this sprint. Right, so I maybe have Mark's going to take 3 days off. I actually need to give it dates. So Mark is off from then until then. Good. Okay, fine. The clock versus when it thinks this sprint is. It doesn't want me to put vacation dates there outside the sprint. And it's just easier to continue on. But anyway, if I don't fill in these activities, then I won't be doing the activity tracking over here. But this is what allows me to have this. And if you find it useful, use it. And if you don't, don't. I tend to work in a very extreme programming kind of a way, which is I expect my team, whoever comes available, to take the next highest priority task and get it done instead of assigning out the work. So I'm much more interested in the big number at the top. Have we picked too much or too little? Do we need to take some more work into the sprint? So I do typically come in and fill in capacity per day. I don't typically fill in the activity. And I basically ignore these two bottom sections, focusing entirely on this top one to try to figure out if I have enough work. And that works for me. You have to find the right way to do it. And again, the tool lets you make that decision yourself. So here we are then. We have our backlog plan. We have a sense of the work we're going to get done. We have all of the tasks. We're now ready to go, and the sprint starts. This planning activity is something that is continuous. So as a product owner, I mentioned that I'm always prioritizing that backlog. I'm always reassessing that backlog in light of feedback, in light of interaction with the team, just my own thoughts, things I read, what the competitors are doing, what the marketing team wants, what my manager wants. I'm always doing that. I'm also often starting to look ahead at what the next sprint might be. But again, I'm not the one who does tasking, nor am I the one who does assignments. I'm the product owner. But I can start to think about if it's going to be that one or this one or this one, do I need to improve the storyboards? I want to make some changes there. So I'm getting ready. The items nearest the top of my backlog are the ones most prepared for the team to consume. And the ones further down are the least prepared for the team to consume. And that way I'm always ready to go when we hit the next sprint and we're ready to enter into planning again. The team then will have access to all the information they need, and my management team understands what it is we're going to build and roughly when we'll deliver it. So as we're continuing on down our process here, the next step along the way here is executing on the plan. This has been, as I said, my area of interest for most of the cycle because I want to make developers more efficient. I want to make us faster. I want to make us produce better quality code in everything we do. And I actually care probably more about quality and design even than I do about fast, because I think that's kind of taking the long-term approach versus the short-term approach. Now, there are certainly cases in certain businesses, in certain markets, maybe for whatever it is you're building, where the design purism, you know, object-oriented purist design is maybe not the most important thing. And you do need to make sure that you think about that carefully. Don't fall into the trap of assuming you need absolutely perfect, pure, object-oriented design with all the solid principles for every single thing you do. People who've heard me speak for years are probably very surprised to hear that from me. But if I am building an app that has a 2-week lifespan and is used by 3 people in the accounting department, and then we're going to throw it away, I don't need that. What I need is something that works, and I need it tomorrow. And so always be thinking about that. Those are actually requirements. Those contribute to your sense of the backlog. They contribute to how the team thinks about tasking out the work. And then, of course, it follows all the way through to how we're going to execute on the plan. So here we are in the loop, and each one of those little loops on the side is a developer consuming a task and working on their stuff. So there's a number of things that are very interesting to us that are potential ways for us to keep track of what's happening and to understand how we're proceeding. This is another one of those places where the Agile community has been going through a bit of an evolution or a revolution in reaction to how people have consumed the data. We all love data. Our managers like it even more than we do. And one of the problems is this guy down here, this burn down chart. I still remember the first time I was asked to come to a stakeholder meeting with my general manager, and I was asked to bring my burndown chart. I said no. That caused a bit of a conversation. General manager of Visual Studio. I said no for a very good reason. This is for the team. This is my opinion I'm giving you here, but I don't think it's far from generally agreed upon practices today. This is for me and for the team to be tracking how we are doing and how we think we're proceeding. Do we need to go back to the stakeholder and have a conversation about making some changes to the plan? This is for the team to know how they're doing. You don't want to use it as a tool for forcing weekend work. That's what I've seen people try to do. You also want to acknowledge if it's just showing the truth, you might not like it. I have seen burndown charts that go across like this, and then down, and then across, and then down. And people try to think, that can't be right. We can't show that to the boss. Yeah, don't show it to the boss. You know, what this is for you to get a sense of how you've been proceeding, and that's all you should use it for. And if you find yourself in a situation where it's being used for something else, I would encourage you to have that conversation instead. But this is a tool I like. Some people don't. Of course, here you can see the work is proceeding. We're executing along, and it's the same data, in fact. There's lots of different ways to represent these kinds of data. Now, we're talking about the execution time. We're talking about the developers. If we assume for a moment that we are not working on the app that has a two-week lifespan and that we're working on a piece of software that we care very much about, we care very much about its quality, we care very much about its design, we want to make sure that it is well-tested, well-thought-through, composable, decoupled, cohesive, all those words. One of the best techniques you can adopt to do this is aggressive unit testing. And so I'm calling this red-green refactor. And that comes from the TDD idea, test-driven development, that you write a failing test red, you make it pass green, and then while green, refactor. And if we take a look at what that, you know, looks like kind of in a visual metaphor, there's my failing test, I wrote some code, it passes. Do it again, it passes. One more time, it passes. And of course, all along the way here, we're doing the simplest thing that could possibly work, which means this code has not had any design rigor applied to it. We've not put any strong attention to design. In test-driven development, the refactoring step is when you are doing design. It is not, you're not designing before that. And this is where some people get a little bit muddled on the idea of test-driven development should be called test-driven design or example-driven design. And I actually disagree, because I'm not designing while I'm writing my tests. Precisely. It's a component. I'm more interested in the design that comes about as a result of refactoring. So here I am. I've produced this massive pile of code. I'm going to refactor it. I'm now going to, now that I see what it has become in response to the criteria and the tests that have been pushed upon it, that have driven out what needed to do, now I'm able to design. Now I can extract interfaces and extract methods and restructure things in order to remove duplication, in order to simplify that code down to the simplest thing it could possibly be. And suddenly it gets smaller. And then we repeat. So this is the act of TDD. Now, there's a whole bunch of things that are inside of Visual Studio, and I'm now going to switch over to the Visual Studio side for just a minute. So this is where I left us off, right? This is what we had finished at the end of the sprint plan. The team has spent some time. We've tasked out the work. And in the morning, we get together for stand-up. And when we come together for stand-up, what we do is we open up our task board. And here is our nice task board keeping track of what we have. The rows are the product backlog items or the stories. The cards going across are the tasks. And so we can imagine that I'm the developer on the team, and I come in and I say, well, I finished this one yesterday. Zero, and it's done. So I need to do something else. So I'm going to take this one. Now, let me put it back for a second. Because right now what I'm in is I'm in a view that we have that allows me to see everything, right? It happens to be that these are assigned to me, but I could just as easily have, you know, assigned them to somebody else on the team. But we have this nice trick of if I go over here and pick myself, so this is the way my team likes to use this tool, is when it's their turn, they'll come over and they'll pick their name, and then they'll talk about their work. And that way every change they make gets associated with them. They're the ones who made that change. So that means if I take this work and drag it over here, it also assigns it to me because I'm the one who dragged it over. Again, shorthand, but it makes life really easy. And if you're using touch screens, of course, and I am, it works. There. So I've done that now. I've taken that work and I've dragged it over and I've said, that's what I'm going to work on next. The team finishes their stand-up meeting, kind of the daily planning meeting is another way to look at it. And I go back to my desk. When I get to my desk and I open up Visual Studio and I get our project open, we're often familiar with, you know, where do we start? Here I am, I'm looking at a big empty Visual Studio. Where does my day begin? I've just finished the stand-up meeting. Well, I might bring up a web page and go back over here. But I'm in Visual Studio, and this is in TFS, so I think I know. I think Visual Studio probably knows what I'm supposed to be doing. So we now have in Team Explorer, and I'm going to open this out just a bit so you can see it. If I go back to the home, you can see there's this thing called My Work. And My Work is a nice interface for you as a developer to interact with these tasks straight from within Visual Studio and get the optimizations that you get from that integration. So let me show you what that means. So this in progress area here has nothing in it because I said I was done. I dragged it over. So I'm going to come down here and grab this task right here, drag it up, drop it right there. That's all I had to do. But what has now happened is that work has been marked in progress, and Visual Studio has started tracking what I'm doing. Not tracking in the sense of, you know, big brother oversight, but tracking in the sense of if I wanted to, I could later put this work away and it would remember where I was. And I'll show you that in just a second. So I've done that. I'm ready to get working. I can double click on it. I can look at the task. Here it is. It's the exact same view we had in the web project. I could perhaps follow a link up to its parent and maybe go take a look at its product backlog item because I want to go read its storyboard, and I could open that up. Read the acceptance criteria. Okay, I understand what I'm supposed to do there. All right, go back over to my task again. Okay, I think I'm feeling pretty good now. I know what I need to do. So if we assume that I'm going to follow a test-driven development kind of a process, then I'm going to end up in a situation where I want to be rapidly iterating over my tests. If you were in the talk I gave this morning, you're going to see some of the same things we talked about there, but in much shorter, abbreviated form. So we've created a new window we call the Test Explorer, which is a developer-focused unit test runner. It supports any test framework that you want. Currently available on the Visual Studio Gallery are JUnit, that's for JavaScript, Jasmine, also for JavaScript. Actually, it's not JUnit, it's QUnit, sorry. QUnit, which is for JavaScript, and Jasmine for JavaScript. We have NUnit, MBUnit, XUnit.net, and in the box, of course, we have the MS Test Manage framework, with a bunch of improvements and changes. If you missed my talk this morning and you want to know what those were, you can go watch the session online. And a new one for C++ development, native C++ development, a proper native unit testing framework. Now, in this project, I'm actually using the XUnit.net test runner framework. So if we go and take a look at what these tests actually look like, you'll see they don't really look like NUnit tests. I've got this fact attribute instead. But you can also see that when I am working and building and running, everything just happens. There's no difference. And in fact, the JavaScript ones, this one here, and my managed code ones, and if I had them, my C++ ones, are all running together. Now, I want to point out something just so you can watch it happen. As a developer, if I'm doing that TDD loop, I'm doing that red-green refactor thing. So, I mean, in my head, what happens is I think about the next little slice of the problem I want to do, and I write a test. And I want to see it turn red. So, you know, I build, and then I run it. And then, okay, it failed, because I knew it needed to do that. And then I go, and I write some code. And so I build, and then I run it. And I see it pass. And then I write a new test, and I build, and then I run it. So when we're doing our refactoring, one of our favorite reasons to do refactoring is the removal of duplication. There's some duplication in process happening there. I'm building it, saving, and I'm building, and I'm running. I'm saving, I'm building, and I'm running. Let's make that go away. If we go look up here in the test menu under settings, I have this option, run tests after build. And it is also here as a nice button in the toolbar. So what this means now is as I am working, I can pretty much ignore the problem of having to, I'm going to just make this line go away. It's a bug in my product code that is having a time zones issue. And because I'm now at, we're plus one here, right? UTC plus one. And I never caught it before because when I was back home, I was always in the same time zone as my server. So I didn't catch it until we showed up here this morning. But cool, now I got to go figure out how to fix it. JSON dates are not fun. Okay, so here I am working, and I want to start writing some new tests. And so if you watch my process here, and I'll talk to you about what I'm doing while I'm doing it, just so you can get a sense of it. All right, so I'm just going to create my new test here, and it's not going to do much because I'm just going to make it fail. False. All right, so I'm making a failing test here. Now, all I'm going to do is hit build. I'm a keyboard guy, not a mouse guy, but it would be the same as if I did build solution. And then I'm going to keep right on typing. Okay? Did you notice that? I was still editing and interacting with the editor. I was still typing, moving my cursor around, doing everything I needed to do. It built, and it ran the test, and the test failed. So that red-green loop has now had all of those extra steps removed. Right? So now I can go and make this test pass. And continue on my merry way. Of course, it's not a very good test. But there's lots of other sessions here this week for you guys to talk to me about testing. The other problem you have as you're developing and working in these systems is, and you're doing a lot of these decoupled designs, is you start to have a problem wanting to create unit tests that run fast. Because you will create a lot of them. I know of a team inside of Microsoft who has 34,600 unit tests. They run in 6 minutes. That's pretty good. 6 minutes. And they don't run them all every time they're working. They only run the ones that are needing to be based on the project that changed because they've got our stuff broken up in all these different projects. And this is a great system because they can just keep working. Go, go, go. Code, code, code. Run, run, run. And it keeps everything's going fast, and it keeps them moving. Now, when you're writing code in this way, you're writing code where the tests are running really fast. In order to achieve that, they have to be decoupled. Your tests have to not have very many dependencies on the environment. Your tests have to be very explicit about what they test and that they don't test anything else. Now, I am not saying that I believe integration tests have no value, but they are different. We do different kinds of testing, and we should be very intentional about when we do one and when we do the other. An integration test is going to be slower. It's going to cost you more. It's also going to be more fragile in potential changes to the environment. As you make changes and add new features, you're going to find integration tests are much more likely to break than unit tests, decoupled unit tests. And when we're doing that, we sometimes find ourselves needing to introduce fake objects. And so in Visual Studio 2012, we have introduced a new framework called Fakes that lets us do stubs. Now, if you've used MOQ or NMOC or Rhino, you're familiar with this. Stub is a concrete implementation of an interface that you get to provide the meaning for to the methods that matter. And so if we take a look, get this out of the way here, at this little chunk right here, not that one. Find me a good stub. So these stubs that we're using, and here's one, stub I earthquake service proxy. So this stub service proxy has a get data async method on it, and I'm assigning it this lambda expression. Lambda expression is just a delegate, of course. We could have used a delegate. I could have used another method inside of my test class. But what that says now is when I pass that object to anybody who expects an I earthquake service proxy, they will get this instead. It's fully implemented, and it has that method body for that one method. And now I'm able to write a test that doesn't depend on the real implementation, which goes all the way out to the United States government's Geological Survey earthquake database thingy. that's not going to make my tests run fast. I want my tests to be really, really fast. And if you look at the times on these tests that I have over here, a large number of them are less than 10 milliseconds of runtime. That's the kind of runtime you're going to need to get in order to, when you're running the numbers of tests that we're talking about here. Now, when you can't isolate in a way that uses interfaces, using dependency injection and decoupling and things like that, because you have a dependency that you just can't get around, the Fakes framework also provides a thing called shims. And shims lets you replace basically anything in .NET. You can just make it go away. And I have a whole talk on that on Friday, and I gave a brief demo of it this morning. So if you want to hear more about that, we'll go into it in one of those two sessions, because it's a pretty deep topic. But it lets me replace pretty much anything I want. And so in this example that's on the screen right now, I'm actually removing a timer, one of the .NET timer classes. And that's good stuff, because now it lets me write my tests so that they run fast. It lets me test exactly what I think I need to be testing. Now, the other thing that happens sometimes is when we're in that refactoring phase, or at any point in time in the project, we might find ourselves wondering, do we have any duplication that we need to go and clean up? Or you're looking at a chunk of code and you say, I've seen this before. I don't remember where, but I've seen this before. And so what we can do is we can go into Visual Studio now and we can select some code. And I'll just select that line for fun. And we can say find matching clones in solution. And this is not a string match. It's not really even a token match. Things like renaming of variables is not going to fool us. That's not going to trick us up. Because we remove all of that noise, replace them with standardized tokens, and then we search for the pattern, basically the mathematical equation that represents that line. And we search for chains of them together so you can start to find big blocks of code. So if I ask it to go and hunt for that, you can see he found 6 clones of that. And you can see he's saying, in fact, he's saying they're strong matches. They're not exact matches. So they are clearly different. So we have the original. We have 1 exact match. And we have 5 strong matches. Well, if we wanted to compare the two, I can select them both, and I can right-click and say compare. And we now get a side-by-side diff view that lets us see how they're different. The only difference is the name of the variable being passed in. But we were still able to detect this change. And in fact, you can continue, you can insert lines, remove lines, do all kinds of things, and we'll still find them. And this is a great way to find duplication in your code. And when your project is sufficiently sized, in fact, you can go up here to the Analyze menu, and you can scan the entire solution for clones. Now, this is looking for clones of 10 lines or more. Right? We're potentially processing millions of lines of code here, and there is a mathematical scaling problem here if we were to look at smaller sets than 10. That 10 is based on a lot of analysis out of Microsoft Research for kind of an appropriate size for real enterprise-sized projects. So we can do that to scan the entire solution. We can use it for finding small bits if we want. Yeah, it only found 2 10-line chunks that were the same in my small project here. And they are exactly the same. So clearly I copied a chunk of code from one place to another, and now is an excellent opportunity for me to refactor that away. So now I'm sitting here working on my task. I'm doing my job. I'm getting close to being done, but I'm not really quite done. You know, I've got some windows open. I may have, I've got a couple of files open. Let's look at which ones I'm going to open here. And so I've got a couple things open that I'm paying attention to. And, your boss comes running down the hallway. You can hear him coming. The feet are pounding. And you bang, bang, bang on your door. We have a massive bug. The site's down. I need you to fix it right now. And you're like, dude, my code doesn't even compile right now. Well, fortunately, we can help you there. So I'm going to go back over to my work. It knows I have this active task. It even knows I have some edits pending and things like that. I'm going to click suspend. And I'm going to say, we'll come back to this later. And I'm going to suspend it. Okay? Now, what's happening behind the scenes is it takes all of your changes and puts them into a shelf set. It restores your workspace back to the way it was before the pending changes began. It closes all your documents and gets you back to a neutral state. So this is where I was before I dragged that work item up. Remember, I told you it was tracking what you were doing. So now I come down here and I take that bug and I drag it up here because that's the bug the boss just told me I needed to go work on. I read about the bug. I understand what I've got to do. I go in my code. I write some tests. I write some code. I fix the bug. I push deploy, whatever I need to do. I'm happy, right? Maybe actually force an edit here. Okay. We'll go back over to my work and see where we stand. So it knows we have an edit pending here. So I'm going to go ahead and check this one in. And when I check it in, you'll notice it has already associated the work item for me. If any of you like to have your check-ins associated with work items and have found that your developers never remember to do it, no longer. So I'm going to go ahead and say the bug is fixed. And I can choose to resolve the work item or not. This bug is fixed. I'm going to go ahead and resolve it and check it in. So now the changes are going up. We're back to neutral again. And if I go back over to my work, I have this one suspended. This one that I said I was going to come back to later. I'm going to now resume it. I'm just going to click once and you can watch what happens. Hands off. It's going to pull that shelf set down. And with it also comes knowledge of where my environment was, what breakpoints I had set, what windows I had open, what watch variables I had configured, and I'm exactly where I was before the boss stormed into my office. This lets the developer stay fluid and focused while at the same time acknowledging the reality of your annoying boss. So I continue down this cycle. Eventually, I finish up all of the tasks, and I can come back to stand up tomorrow and say, we are done with this user story. Let's move on to another one. Still have a lot of work to do here, but I think we actually have done a fair amount to help the agile developer have a much more fluid experience. And we're entirely integrated into the IDE and building high-quality systems. So there's a bit about our executing loop. Now, of course, one of the most important things and the reasons we do all of this agile stuff in the first place is because we know we can't see very well into the future. We can't plan a 2-year product cycle today and expect that in 2 years we will deliver what we want in 2 years. Instead, we'll deliver what we think we want today. So change is real, and so we need to think about how to incorporate change back into our process. And in fact, it's going to come about in the ways we've already discussed. We finished the sprint, and we have this idea of velocity. We know how much work we finished in these previous sprints. So we can use that to make predictions about how much work we can do, and we can start to incorporate that back. That's feedback back into the system that's going to affect our future planning. We also have the feedback from our customers who are using the product, feedback from our testers, from the team, from the stakeholders, from everybody involved. All of that feeds back into it. And we'll put some more work on the backlog. We'll reprioritize. We're now back at the front again. We'll continue to do this work. Adjusting sizing, because that's the other thing that happens, right? You finish a body of work, you finish a story, and then you suddenly discover, ooh, that thing we thought that was going to take 30 hours is almost done now because we kind of got it for free because of this other thing over here. So you adjust all of those and continue on. Now, there's a couple things I want to hit before we go on. And they're back over here. And I want to talk a little bit about velocity and forecasting. So back when we were on the product backlog over here, we were looking at the entire product backlog. I said just a second ago, one of the pieces of data that is very important to us is how well have we been trending? What has our velocity been? And we can use that to answer the age-old question that our bosses love to ask, when will I get number 7? Right? It's so far down the backlog, you really don't have a very good answer. And I have been known to say, do you want me to lie? Or not answer? It's really your choice. But I can actually, that's a little bit dishonest. Because in fact, if this priority stack is correct, and if our effort numbers are reasonable, two ifs, then in fact I can forecast when you will have number 7. And I can use this thing we have called the forecasting lines. So I turned on forecasting up here, and he is currently working with a forecasting velocity of 5. So what that means is the tool is going to automatically come in and enter in. These are the blank ones I created just a minute ago. And give me these lines to help me identify where these future sprints are going to land and what work will hit in them. So again, it depends very much on consistency of velocity, which we kind of assume, but at the same time, if your team is undergoing a lot of change, you have to acknowledge that that may not always be true. But if we assume a consistent velocity of 5 effort points, then this is roughly where it's going to proceed. And you'll notice it did not cross over. It will not overstack you. So, in fact, Sprint 8 only has 4 points in it, because taking the next highest priority item would have moved it to 6. This is, again, consistent with my recommendation of don't sign up for stretch goals. Sign up for work that is actually reasonably within your allowance and what you can achieve. So this is a very, very useful tool for starting to get a sense of when things are going to happen and looking into the future. Because it is always the case that we have dates and times and milestones that matter. Think about Visual Studio. We had to ship the beta. Before that, we had the technical preview. And just recently, we've had the RC. And soon, we have the RTM. These dates are real. And trust me, a little guy like me is not allowed to show up and say, I want to move the date by a week. That does not fly. So it is very, very useful for me, in fact, if I know that, say, RTM is happening at Sprint 9. It will affect the way I will prioritize the work. It will have an impact on me as the product owner and allow me to make intelligent decisions about stack ranking when I can see this kind of forecasting into the future. This I find a very useful tool for communicating with my management, much more than a burndown, much more useful than a burndown. Oh, question in the front, yes. So the question was, what if you know that your velocity will change in one particular sprint? Half the team is on vacation. Yeah, I understand your point, and we don't really have a way for you to specifically pick out on a sprint-by-sprint basis. This is about kind of assumed kind of continuity forecasting. So you would end up having to look at that one and say, yeah, the bottom's all going to have to slide up a little bit. So it's not perfect, but it does give you a sense. For the most part, except for those occasional times where, you know, the whole team goes on vacation or we all come to Europe for Tech Ed, for the most part, it actually does help and does have a pretty good conversation. I mean, our team is up on Sprint 37 at this point. And, you know, we've got some pretty good historical data about our velocities, about what we've been able to achieve. And, you know, it was pretty useful for me to be able to say it's about 4 sprints out, about 5 sprints out. Much beyond that, I would say it's all garbage because I never have anything more than the top 10 of my items in the product backlog stack rank. Top 10 is good enough. Beyond that, I don't care because I probably just won't do it. It was Mary Popendick who said, if it's more than 2 sprints away, just delete it. Got to find an approach that works for you. Okay. So let's go back over here. So I mentioned at the beginning, I've been doing agile development for 10 plus years. I started, the very first article I read on extreme programming, I saw in, I think it was the Java Programming Journal, 10 or 11 years ago, and immediately recognized it as something, as the right way to build software, because everything we'd tried before that hadn't worked. And so I've been doing it this whole time, and for the last now 8.5 years, I've been at Microsoft. I was fortunate enough to be involved in the Patterns and Practices team when we had all those big team rooms, and we were doing Enterprise Library and CAB and Unity and all those things, and very, very agile team. We had Ward Cunningham, who's kind of the grandfather of Agile and the creator of Wiki. We had Jim Newkirk, who created NUnit. We had tons of amazing people. And so it was a really interesting opportunity to really experience a high-performing Agile team. Since moving to Visual Studio for the last 4 years, I brought that with me. And inside of Visual Studio, we have becoming more and more and more Agile. We're basically Scrum across the board in the Visual Studio ALM side. And many of our teams have, in fact, started to go to a more continuous delivery model. Not all of them. That's kind of depends on the team and on what they're delivering and how well that works out for them culturally. But I wanted to spend a few minutes and just go through 10 points that Aaron Bjork and I. Aaron is my colleague on the TFS side. He does the same job as me, but on all the web TFS stuff I've been showing you. He and I put together this list a few years ago and have been talking it through with people just to share with you some of the things we've learned doing agile development. And so I'll just take you through a couple of these. I mentioned at the beginning defining done and how important defining done is. And so I put it number one on the list here. I think it is the most important thing. And there is done at all levels of your software development process. You'll have what does it mean to be done with a task, with a story, with a sprint, with an iteration, with a release. If you're doing a web-based product, you may have a done that allows you to move into the staging environment. You might have a different done that allows you to move out of the staging environment into production. Be very clear about done, about what it means to be done. And it's not something that you should allow to be imposed upon you necessarily by management. The team has to believe very strongly in the definition of done. And in order to do that, they have to participate in defining it, in creating that. That's a very, very important one. The second one is fail fast. You may have heard this phrase. My usage of it might be a little bit different. Fail fast for me is I am much happier to have anything I do fail today instead of fail tomorrow. It's always better. If I'm not going to achieve a task, I'd like to figure that out today. If I'm not going to be able to build a feature at all for some technical reason, I would rather know that today. This also manifests itself in how you communicate. I will never show up at an end of sprint review with my manager and be effectively failing the sprint, and that's the first time he hears about it. Oh no. Unless it actually happened the day before. But that doesn't happen either, right? You know when you're in trouble halfway through the sprint, and that's when you need to start communicating it. Anytime you can start to bring that forward. This is the idea of every defect you find earlier is an order of magnitude cheaper than one you find late. This manifests itself everywhere. Fail fast at anything and everything you do. Paper prototyping is an excellent way to fail fast. Try out a crazy idea of a new user interface. Take it to people. Show it to them. Maybe make a very quick little mock-up, throwaway mock-up, that they can actually click and drive, maybe in web or with WinForms or who knows whatever else. That allows you to test out the idea early rather than investing 3 months of product development time with a crew only to discover everybody hates it. Fail fast. Understanding your velocity. I think I mentioned this, I covered this just a minute ago, but let's hit it again. You cannot do any forecasting whatsoever. You cannot answer the question of when will we deliver this? How fast are we going? When do we expect to get there? You can't do any forecasting whatsoever if you aren't tracking your velocity. And it's really not that hard to do anymore. Since we have the MyWork and the developer is activating those tasks and finishing those tasks, a lot of that data is now getting entered for you. The team gets together for stand-up and they adjust their times on the little cards. We're getting a lot of data now entered in a way that's much easier than it ever was before. I mean, I remember developers having to, you know, run the query or write the work item down on the sticky note that they were working on and stick it next to their keyboard. You don't have to do any of that anymore, which means the data is current, which means you really can get it out of TFS. And you can know how many stories you've finished looking back in time. You cannot make any forecast predictions without having a sense of how fast you've been going. Yesterday's weather is king. Finish what you start. This is related to my point of don't do the stretch goal game on a sprint. That is just signing up to not finish what you start. Everything you start, you should take all the way to the end and finish. And if you can't, because your story is too big to finish in a sprint, or maybe your story is a two-sprint long story, the story is too big. Make it smaller. Now, splitting stories is a challenging thing to do. It takes a little bit of effort. It takes creativity. Because sometimes you'll say, but if I make it any smaller, it's not really very useful. It's very useful because it allows the team to finish it. And that's a useful thing. And then taken together with the next one, it becomes useful to the customer. And both of them can be finished in a sprint. Both of them can be comprehended, tasked, estimated, and designed by the team. But that gigantic one, no way. I put a Twitter up a few weeks ago where I said, there's only two estimation sizes that matter, too big and small enough. And beyond that, I really don't care. Does it fit in the sprint? Does it fit in the week? Does it fit in the day? Does it fit in whatever unit you care about? Or is it too big? And then how many of those can I get done? Bugs are real work. We struggle with this one at Microsoft, I'll be completely honest with you. We like to think of bugs as being different and special. We keep them in their own database, and we don't track them on backlogs very well. Don't do that. Bugs are work. You have to make sure that you think of them as work. You have to prioritize them like work. Do you care more about fixing that bug or implementing that story? That's a decision you get to make as a product owner. Don't let it go the other way, where bugs just happen in the background somewhere. Because first of all, that's going to have an impact on your velocity, because now there's suddenly the team can never get done what you expected them to get done or what they even expected to get done because random bugs are coming at them from the side. Ideally, you want your bugs on your backlog. You want to see them. You want to track them. Treat them like work. Write unit tests always. I said it before. You know, the top two things that you can do to improve code quality, one is code review and inspection. That's the team getting together to talk about their code and look at it and care about it. And the second one is automated testing and unit testing. Do it. There's just nothing more to say. And if you're struggling with it, get help. We've done a lot of great things to make it easier, to make it faster. We're still going to be doing more moving forward. Unit testing is very important. Daniel Pink wrote a book that was very popular around some of our circles a while back called Drive. And in that book, he talked about what it is that motivates people. And a bunch of interesting studies were done about how people are motivated. And it turned out that people are not motivated by money. They are, in fact, more likely to decrease their productivity if you give them more money. Thought that was quite fascinating. They really did this with actual scientific studies. Once they've achieved the that's enough money thing, you know, you've got enough. Like if you're starving, clearly more money does make you more productive. But once you cross that boundary, in fact, throwing more at them probably makes them slow down. Instead, what they discovered is there's really three factors: autonomy, mastery, and purpose. People have enough autonomy to make the important decisions that matter to them. That means developers get to make the decisions about their code. The decisions that are appropriate for them to make. If all we have are developers who are typing in code versions of the spec, and you almost could translate them from one to the other with a machine, that developer has no autonomy. They're not going to be very productive, and they're not going to do very high-quality work. Mastery is the idea of let people get a sense of ownership, that psychological, I own, I care, I believe. And purpose is them having a sense that what they're doing matters. These are the three things that motivate people. Agile teams are often very high-functioning agile teams always have these three things, and that's why we bring them up here. And I knew this when I read Daniel's book. I said, wow, every high-functioning agile team I've ever seen has these. So there's clearly an interesting correlation there. Do the right thing at the right time is another way of saying last responsible moment, a favorite agile aphorism, that don't design and go into great detail for the backlog item at position 100. It's not the right time to do that one. It's a waste of time to do that one. Everything you do should have that same lens applied to it. Is it too early? Am I doing it at the right time? If you do it earlier than the right time, it's wasted effort. Plan until you need to learn is that constantly recurring cycle of planning, learning. So that's retrospectives, conversations, analyzing how far you've proceeded, analyzing your design, having code reviews, constantly in that cycle of learning and planning. Don't just do one and not the other. And quality is not a variable. I gave you this one at the beginning. Right? The project management iron triangle is time, scope, resources. Quality is not a variable in that triangle. If you lock in the three sides of the triangle, you just made quality a variable. I want to thank you all for coming out and learning about Agile in Visual Studio and TFS 2012. I will be down at the TLC, which is the expo lounge, down here at the ALM stuff, on and off throughout the rest of the week. This is my contact information. Thank you very much, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of your TechEd.